Welcome, you're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellaro, and this week my guest is macOS software developer, Sandra Behrens. Sandra, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you for joining me. For the listeners, you have been fascinated by astronomy since childhood and have earned a master's degree in astrophysics. You're a professional software developer these days. You are the developer of the macOS app called Observatory, which features stacking and a digital blink microscope used in astrophotography, and version 1 was released in April of 2016. It's a pretty nice app. It's really great for astrophotographers. A friend of mine told me about it, and it looks to be an awful cool program.
So, thank you.
Congratulations on the release of that. I want to get to that in the second half of the show, the technical details of this program called Observatory, which helps out astrophotographers. But first, I wanted to ask you about your career. How did you get interested in astronomy? When and how did that influence your career path?
Well, when I got interested in astronomy, I actually don't know, because as far as I remember, I've always been interested in astronomy. Even when I was a young child, I always knew that I wanted to study astrophysics. I observed a lot when I was a child, and my older brother had a telescope at one point I discovered, so I used that a lot. So that's kind of how I did.
What kind of telescope was it?
Well, that was an old, like, 40-millimeter refractor with a cardboard tube, actually. So I used it for many years until I finally got my own. Initially, I was thinking about, like, you know, increasing the objective, like, you know, to like 50 millimeters. Then I thought like 60 millimeters. But then in the end, I decided to get like a Newton telescope. And I used that also for years.
For the listeners, a Newtonian reflector uses a mirror and reflects the light to a little mirror that shoots the light out the side of the tube. And so you can get a lot more aperture, a lot more light gathering power for your dollar. So that's why a lot of amateur astronomers use Newtonian reflectors instead of refractors. The lens in a refractor has to be high quality and very carefully ground to avoid optical aberrations, and so they can become expensive. Anyway, return from subroutine. So did you study astrophysics in college, in your bachelor's?
Yes, I got a master's in astrophysics, yes. And but after that, I actually went into programming more right away, because actually, since my teens, like, I've always been interested in astronomy and, like, you know, used my telescopes a lot. But since my teens, I completely got into programming as well. So I got, like, you know, as a early teenager, I got this TRS-80. I don't know if you remember that one.
Oh, yes, we do. The Trash 80, we all remember.
Well, that's not how I call it, because I always really appreciated that computer.
So you learned the programming basic. Yeah.
I learned basic, and that you know, this computer came with really nice manuals. It's also the first time I ever learned about like a chapter zero, because it was the first book I saw that. I learned programming like in basic first, and I quickly stepped up to assembler, like the Xilinx C80 assembler. I used that for several years. Like, after 1 year, I even got a floppy disk drive in a machine, because initially I was always using a tape recorder. So it was really exciting. Used this for many years, and later...
Mm-hmm. Did you go to work for a company doing software development at some point, or were you just able to learn on your own?
Well, this was still during my teens. Like, you know, later on, I got an Atari ST, and when I got that machine, I actually started working more and more for companies during my teenage years. So my other computers that I got after that, I usually got through those companies, actually. So I did that with, you know, Atari ST, and then later I got a Mac. Like, you know, the Mac I really got during college. So all these years I was always programming during my college years.
Was it practice programming, or were you building apps that we've heard of?
Well, you may not have heard of it, but I did write for the Atari ST at one point, just for fun, during college. I actually wrote a TRS-80 emulator, which was all written in mostly in assembler and C.
My hat's off to you. Writing a program in assembly language is pretty tricky. I wrote a program in assembly language for the Apple II, and I know where you are coming from. I used a cassette assembler to do graphics on an Apple II. So I bow to your excellence and expertise in programming. Not many people know how to program in assembly.
Well, especially nowadays, when I talk to other people, like in most of the people I meet, like, you know, none of them knows. Like, it's always high level languages, but no, like assembly. And after that, I went to, you know, Pascal, C, C++, and like Java later on. Just like that, I just keep on learning languages.
What's the first company you worked for?
The first company I worked for, well, was like, you know, a small company in the Netherlands. It was right after I finished my master's. I did some Windows programming at that time, and then after that I started working for Big Blue, IBM, also in the Netherlands. But soon after that I did that, like I actually moved to the San Francisco Bay Area, and I started working at IBM Research.
Oh, that must have been amazing. What were you doing there?
It's kind of the same kind of work I was doing for in the Netherlands. It was all big databases, patent data related. This IBM had developed this internal tool for investigating or looking at their own patents. And at one point, this software came kind of public, and I was one of the developers, or actually the main developer, who installed it and enhanced it, like, for different patent offices around the world. So, for example, in the Netherlands, then the UK or Switzerland or Japan, I did that.
So at what point did you transition from working from somebody else to starting your own company?
That was really much later. Like, over the years in Silicon Valley, more and more, I was, you know, not working from home anymore. I was always working remote. And so at IBM, like, you know, I still worked in the office, but then we had our group had a spin-off company. You know, this was all right before the dot-com crash, so everything was still good. But then when I started there, more and more I started working from home, actually, or from other countries, wherever I was. And then slowly over the years, at one point, I decided to start on my own. So, or more, it's not like a one step, because actually during all these years, because I was traveling a lot, I was abroad a lot, I could use my telescopes less and less often. So, I started developing more and more software for myself, astronomy software, which I only used myself. But at one point I wanted to take that a little bit further.
For most people, it's a big jump when you go from working for IBM to working for yourself. There's usually some sort of financial concerns. How did you make that transition from IBM researcher to impoverished software developer?
No, well, IBM Research was one. Like, after IBM Research, our group spun off our own company. So I stopped working for IBM Research, but worked for another company. And after that, for yet another company. So there were a few companies in between. But the step was really because my wife, she works really like in remote locations usually. She goes from country to country, and I follow her. And at one point, we moved to Thailand. And that's really when I decided to start for myself. So.
What kind of telescope do you have these days? And do you ever get out there? And what's the weather like? I always thought of Thailand as to be kind of damp, rainy climate.
Well, that was my big motivator, actually, because I do not have telescopes here. They are all in storage. Because in Thailand, you cannot use your telescopes. No use. Absolutely no use.
Oh, yeah. We don't have great skies where I live either, but it's just
They will
cloudy,
still
but
be a lot better than here. It's just like the weather is really not well suited for this.
Monsoons, I guess, things like that.
Yes, yes. And light pollution. I mean, Bangkok, so.
Oh, okay. So when you started your software company, was Observatory your first release, or was there an app before that?
No, it was Observatory. it's really like, you know, it's a, it, the application really started as like, you know, a accumulation of all the things I did over the years. So parts of Observatory I really had written, I used myself already for years. So several features are, you know, pretty old, but I all combine them in one application. That's really how it got started.
Okay. Well, I think we're ready for a break. In the second half of the show, I want to ask you about the technical details of this app. There's a lot of cool stuff to discuss, but first we need to take a short break. Folks, we'll be right back. I'm talking to Sandra Behrens, macOS developer. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Hi, this is John Martellaro with the Mac Observer. This week, our sponsor is Molecule. Molecule is a complete reinvention of the air purifier, not just an improvement on existing outdated technology. It was developed by a scientist whose son suffered from asthma and who was frustrated by the fact that HEPA air filters did not relieve his son's symptoms. Molecule introduces a breakthrough science that is finally capable of destroying air pollutants at a molecular level. Molecule's Pico technology goes beyond HEPA filtration, which is an old technology, to not just capture but completely destroy the full spectrum of indoor air pollutants, including those 1,000 times smaller than HEPA filter can trap, that is, 0.3 microns. The results have transformed lifelong allergy and asthma sufferers' lives. One customer even said that she was able to breathe through her nose for the first time in 15 years. Molecule's technology has been personally effective and verified by science, but most importantly, it's been tested by real people. Molecule has already helped allergy and asthma sufferers around the country better cope with their conditions and significantly reduce their symptoms. And now Molecule has a special offer for BGM listeners. Visit molekule.com and save $75 off your first order. At checkout, just use promo code BGM. So thanks, Molecule, for being our sponsor. Back talking with Sandra Behrens, macOS developer of the Observatory app. So you mentioned you have a really good background in programming languages. What language did you elect to write Observatory in?
It's a little bit of a mix of languages, mainly Objective-C and it's C, C++. Swift came later. I was already well in the development of Observatory, so I didn't use Swift, which I think was a good choice at the time. But other things I use in Observatory is, for example, OpenCL also I use. These are really the main things.
Ah, OpenCL. Doesn't OpenCL depend on choice of graphics card? There are some graphics cards that support it and some don't.
Yes, but OpenCL it can also run on the CPU. So the OpenCL drivers in macOS, they allow you to execute it on the CPU and the GPU. That's why in Observatory, you can actually select if you want all your computations to happen on the CPU or the GPU.
Ah, I didn't know that. That's good to know. So this Observatory app assists astrophotographers in general. Why don't you give me a thumbnail description of the app, and then we'll get into some of the details after that.
Well, I mean, the first part of the app is actually a little bit, you don't even have to use the app for it. It's the main feature is a quick look and spotlight plugins for different data formats, for image formats that are typically used in astronomy. So you can quickly, you know, view your images up close, even in the Finder without starting the application, or you can search through, you know, your hard disk and actually find your images, for example, you know, by, the camera you used to obtaining the images or the temperature of your CCD camera, things like that. And then the actual application, it's really an image organizer, so you can create multiple libraries of different views of all your images on disk to organize them in albums, you know, smart albums. You can tag them and you can write comments to them. And then in addition to that, it has features like plate solving and it can, you know, show overlays of galaxies and stars and nebula, exoplanets, host, whatever, on your images. Also has some basic non-destructive image pre-processing in it. So you do image calibration or, you know, hot cold pixel removal, image registration. And then also some other tools like, you know, even a virtual observatory, so you can quickly and easily search professional databases, image databases, for, you know, you can easily import the images from the Hubble Space Telescope, for example, or from the European Southern Observatory. Oh, and so these are really the research images.
So it has to be able to handle FITS images, which is what astronomers use.
Yes, it handles FITS images. That's really what astronomers use. And it handles also several other formats there. And so with the virtual observatory feature, you can really get the raw research data from these different observatories. It's not the images you see in the press, but really the raw original images.
Excellent. If I understand the pictures I've seen of the app, you can overlay right ascension declination coordinates on your photo, right?
Yes, you can. You first have to place solve them for that, or maybe some of your equipment already produces the right information in the headers of the images. So it knows, the application needs to know, of course, where in the sky the image is taken.
How does it do that? So, I mean, you've got an image. When we have terrestrial images, they're geotagged with latitude and longitude. But when you take an astronomical photo with a CCD, do you have to use metadata associated with it and then integrate that into your catalog?
Yes, for example, the FITS file format that it contains, you can add headers there, and it's a standard for this. Yeah, so it can include these headers that you know exactly the coordinates and image scale, all this kind of information can be contained in the FITS headers.
So you have a right ascension declination system in the sky, and then you import the photo, and then the plate solving figures out where in the sky catalog the image appears, and then it drops it in. And you can put it in the context of other stars that are around it, right? And the lines, the coordinate lines.
Yeah, yeah. So, if you import an image that already is, a plate solved like this, if it has this information, then observatory doesn't have to do that. But if it doesn't, then you have two methods in observatory where you can enter an estimated center of the image, or where you think the image is taken, of an estimated image scale. So it can plate solve it itself, or you can actually use a blind plate solver if you really have no idea where in the sky this image was taken. You just select that option, and then observatory will figure it out.
How does it do that? Whoa, that's interesting to me. How does it do that? How does it do blind plate solving?
The blind plate solver actually uses an online connection to a service for this. It's astrometry.net. So it's not that the observatory itself does that. The blind plate solving is done by another service, but observatory translates the information that to import that information.
Okay. So one of the things astrophotographers do is, because of various limitations or rotation of the field on a certain kind of mount or sky conditions, is you take several photographs or images, CCD images of an object in the sky, and now you have a collection of them, and you can get a better image from multiple images if they're what's called stacked. Can you explain that?
Yeah, stacking is also a feature in observatory. So it's really a technique where you combine multiple images into one. And it's by doing that, you really increase the dynamic range of an image, and you increase also the signal-to-noise ratio in the images. So you just add the pixels of the different images. Now, that, of course, assumes that you took all these images from exact the same location in the sky, because you have to really add them accurately to do this. And hence, there is also a feature in observatory where you can actually register your images so they are aligned all by the stars that are in the images.
Right.
They are properly aligned, and then they are stacked.
There may be some tilt or angle, or the images may not be exactly the same.
Exactly. And also, you often do that on purpose, actually. You move your camera between the exposures to not hit the same pixel on the camera. So for the best results, you move it around a little bit.
Cool. Nice trick. How many images can observatories stack? Is there a limit?
There is a limit, but the limit is all dependent on your memory, the amount of memory you have in your machine, because observatory does all the stacking purely in memory. So it does use internal compression, so it can stack quite a lot. But it really depends on on the size of your images, how many pixels they have, and then, I don't know, how much memory you have in your machine.
Most of us have 8 or 16 gigabytes of RAM. A few of us have 32. Is it recommended that 32 gigabytes would be really cool? Because that's a hot number these days in the Mac world.
Yeah. I mean, as much as possible.
Okay.
That's it. And if you don't have enough memory, it still will work, especially if you if your Mac is equipped with a with a SSD. Because then, like, you know, Mac OS is pretty efficient in that case. If it's equipped with a hard disk, then if you don't have enough memory, then it becomes really slow. So,
yeah. Okay. Another feature of Observatory is what's called an electronic or digital blink microscope. This goes back to the days when astronomers took photographic plates, and they would place these plates on a special instrument, and like Clyde Tombaugh did when he discovered Pluto, you would look at two different photographic plates and try to detect movement to see if there was a planet or an asteroid moving. So explain to us how that works.
Well, you see, if you take, you know, two images of the same area in the sky, but at different times, and there is an object moving in between that time, and you switch quickly between these images, all the stars will remain in the same position, but you see this one moving object appearing there. And Observatory has a similar feature, I mean, not manually like this, like the old method, but you can select multiple images, and if you have aligned them, then you can just, you know, blink them in the same way. So you see your, you know, your asteroids or whatever is in your images. You can see it moving.
Does the movement depend on your eye, or is there any kind of electronic detection as well?
No, right now it's just your eye. You just have to do it manually. So you can use it for asteroids or for supernovas detection to see, like, you know, you would take an image of a galaxy, and then later, you know, or, you know, many times over the year, you take images of the same galaxy, and if there's a supernova appearing, you also see suddenly, like, you know, a star appear there.
One of your beta testers, Mike Wiesner, was on the show recently, and he started a supernova patrol program, and he told me about how he uses Observatory to detect changes in the brightness of a star in a galaxy, which might indicate that it has gone supernova. That's pretty cool. Observatory also works as a non-destructive photo library. Is it sort of like Apple's Photos app? Tell me about that.
Yeah, it works a little bit like Apple Photos app, but with Apple's Photos app, you can only have one photo library at a time. You can switch between different libraries, but you can have only one open at a time. With Observatory, you can have multiple open at a time. It doesn't matter. And it works similarly. Like, you know, a library is really like, you know, a document that it contains references to your original images, your master images on disk. And when you apply adjustments to the images, for example, you rotate it or you align them or stack them, it all references to these original images, but it doesn't produce any new images. It's very, you know, efficient.
Can you search by metadata to bring up images for a certain part of the sky?
Yeah, you can search, like, because as soon as you import an image in an Observatory library, what importing really is it reads the image headers and it, you know, obtains the, you know, correct information from that, and that's really stored in an internal database in this, you know, library document. So you can easily search by different things in the library, and you can add your own things there. You can add notes, for example, or attachments to the files and everything. And the great benefit of this is, of course, that, like, you know, if you have your images on disk, you look at them in one way. You have, for example, organized them all by date. But with Observatory, you can just import these images, and then maybe you make one library where you, you know, organize them by object type or by just like a current, you know, you have a current interest in something. You create a library specifically for that. Or what I did once too, like, you know, I imported my images and I was just, using Observatory, I actually found out which of my old images contained exoplanets hosts. So just things like that. Because as soon as you import an image that is plate solved, or if you plate solve an image, Observatory will not only display overlays, but it will also automatically start tagging the images. So it tags them with the information of what is inside the image. So if it detects that there is a galaxy or, you know, a planetary nebula or, you know, a exoplanet host star in your image, it will automatically tag that image. So next time you can easily find, you can just click on one, you know, item in an observatory, and you see all your images that have planetary nebula or.
Very cool. Now this app is Mac OS only, right?
Yes.
Does that mean that it's limited to amateur astronomers, or do you know of any professional astronomers and observatories who are making good use of it?
I sell it through the Mac App Store, so it's all anonymous. But from the support questions I get in, I do know that it's used by many professionals as well, yes.
Cool. Now, when we think about Mac App Store or the iOS App Store, we tend to think about the downward spiral of software prices and how developers labor lovingly over their app, and then they release it for 99¢ because they're afraid that people won't buy their app if it's too expensive. But in your case, you have a very special, very technical, very high-quality product here that does some exceptional optical things. And it sells for, what, $79? Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
How has been the reaction to your customers to that pricing? Tell me about that. And how did you develop that price? And what kind of feedback are you getting on it from customers?
Well, the pricing, I always got the feeling like, you know, in general, equipment for your telescopes is not very cheap. So too low a price, I don't think it would have been a good choice. So I was a little bit thinking about, like, you know, have a good price that is not too cheap, but also not too expensive, because when you have a price that is too low, then I would also have a bigger customer support burden. And so I kept the price at that point. Like many software in this area is, you know, generally much more expensive. You have free software or expensive software. So this is a little bit in the middle, you know. And in general, the response has been good. I mean, there are always people who really only want to pay $1 for something. This is not a program for them in that case.
Didn't Sky and Telescope review it? I forget when. If I saw the review, I forgot about it.
Yeah, they did in the March edition of this year. They did.
Oh, I'll have to go back and look at that. What did Sky and Telescope think of it?
They were very positive about it, for sure. They really loved the quick look and the spotlight features. So you can just, even without starting the application, you can find all your, you know, images. Because if you don't use Observatory, all your FITS files or your, you know, PixInsight files, they will just look as, like, you know, generic documents in the Finder. But with Observatory, they really look like images, and you can find them. And they were also very positive about the Virtual Observatory feature. So it was a very nice review.
Did that generate a lot of new sales that you could identify?
Yes, it did. Yeah.
Excellent. It must be. Must be nice to have a big cash flow like that come in when somebody reviews it. That's nice.
That's true.
Tell me, what's new in the latest version of Observatory?
The current version, you mean? Well, the last version I really imported. I added the exoplanets and variable stars and double star support. I added more exoplanets. I also added a Sky Safari integration, which means that if your images are plate solved, and then you just with one click, Observatory can open Sky Safari and it will show the exact same location in Sky Safari.
Ah, excellent. I've reviewed Sky Safari. It's one of my favorite apps.
Nice. Yeah, it works really nice together.
Do you have any future plans for features that you can tell us about? I don't want you to give up any secrets, though.
Yeah, no, I have many future plans. There's a lot more coming.
I had to ask.
Yeah. One slightly obvious thing that I can say, it's kind of obvious with the next macOS release, is that dark mode is coming to Observatory as well.
Obviously.
Many, many people have been asking for that. So
that's so obvious. Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Observatory in dark mode. That rings off a ton.
Yes. And the way it's going to be implemented is really that it's, on the next macOS version, it's completely dark mode. But even on the older macOS versions, it will also work with some limitations, but it will also have dark mode. So it's pretty neat.
All right. So this has been a great tour of your app. I want to thank you for joining me and telling me about this. We're just about out of time. I have just one more question for you, and that is, whenever I have a developer on the show, I like to ask them about how they feel about being in the Apple ecosystem and being an Apple developer. Have there been any particular frustrations, or has it been 100% fun? How does it feel to be in the Apple development system? And tell me about your experience.
Yeah, well, to me, it's an absolutely great development environment. I love Xcode and Cocoa. I mean, really, it's really good. I'm releasing on the Mac App Store. That's a little bit of a mixed bag there, because the Mac App Store has been grossly neglected over the years. So that's not so great. There will be some changes in the coming macOS release, but it's still Mac App Store. I'm not so happy about, really.
So, did you have to make some painful changes to the app to get it into the Mac App Store?
I hear a lot of these stories that people have lots of problems with rejects, or it takes a week to review in the Mac App Store. Mm-hmm. Never happened for me. Every time it was reviewed within 24 hours, not a big deal. And I have very few rejects. The only reject I really had was that version 1.1, I included Acorn plugins in my application. And I was really thinking I wonder if Apple will accept that. They did. So they accepted it in 1.1. But then later, when 1.2 was released, they rejected it, actually, because I had included these plugins. So I had to remove those. But in general, I never have any rejections, and it's probably also because my application, it compiles with all warnings enabled, and I have not a single warning in my when I compile it. So it's just I have no problems with that, a good experience with that. My frustration with the Mac App Store is mainly because it has been neglected by Apple, and it's difficult to discover applications, and searching is broken, really, I think, even on the latest macOS releases.
Where do you get most of your advertising from? I mean, how do you make it known? Do you advertise in astronomy magazines, or do you depend on word of mouth? How does that work?
It's really word of mouth, and also on a few websites, like some news groups, maybe forums, things like that.
All right. Well, we're out of time. I want to thank you for joining me. It's been a nice discussion of a really great astronomy app. And hopefully you'll get some more press, and people will send you more money.
After
they hear the podcast. So tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
Just go to codeobsession.com. And there you have all the information about the application, even the documentation, and all the email addresses to contact me.
Excellent. It's been fun. Folks, you've been listening to the Mac Observer. I've been chatting with Sander Behrens, developer of the Observatory app. And we hope if you're an amateur astronomer, you will go buy it and use it. So thanks for joining us, and we will be back next week.
Thank you.